As always, I preface any time I speak about things like this, this is not my professional life. I'm not trained and educated theologian or Bruce. This is something I've had great interest in. The resurrection is something I've really thought a lot about, read a lot about over the years, so it's something that does interest me. But I am not deeply credentialed. So I'm here to work with you in having a conversation about what we think this particular passage is saying to us. So this week we're going to talk about the passage in John where Mary encounters Jesus in the garden, the first appearance. Then next week we're going to talk about Doubting Thomas, which is today's gospel. And then the final week we'll take the passage from Luke that talks about the road to Emmaus. So those will be our three passages that we'll work around. The core of our faith is found in the most ancient and earliest records of the church. You see it referred to in Paul's letters. He talks about Christ died for our sins in accordance with the scriptures. He was buried. He was raised on the third day in accordance with the scriptures. So this death, burial, resurrection, very ancient tradition in the life of the church. All four of the Gospels attest to the empty tomb. As you know, the Gospel accounts...
It's already on.
I have this.
Yeah, that was... Try that now.
Yeah. Is that working? Is that working? Okay. All four Gospels attest to the empty tomb, but then, as you know, they really go off in different directions in terms of the stories that they relate about post-resurrection.
So is the other one still on?
Yep. Red.
It only gets affected when it gets close to you, so maybe even though that's off, you might just take that off in time.
Technology is like me. Hello? Okay, is that better?
No, I like the first one best.
Is it?
All right, so... I'll turn that one off and try this one again. Sorry.
Hello?
That's all.
Okay. Can you hear now?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. Here we go. Stay there. Strong evidence from the early church that we have a very rich tradition of post-resurrection stories, post-resurrection appearance stories. So there's these two threads that we have running through. We have the empty tomb, and then we have the appearances. This passage that we're going to focus on today offers the perspective of both the empty tomb and a resurrection, post-resurrection appearance. So the passage is John 20, 1-18, which I'd like to read so we have it fresh in our minds. Early on the first day of the week, while it was still dark, Mary Magdalene went to the tomb and saw that the stone had been removed from the entrance. So she came running to Simon Peter and the other disciples, the one Jesus loved, and said, "They have taken the Lord out of the tomb, and we don't know where they have put him. So Peter and the other disciple started for the tomb. Both were running, but the other disciple outran Peter and reached the tomb first. He bent over and looked in at the strips of linen lying there, but did not go in. Then Simon Peter came along behind him and went straight into the tomb. He saw the strips of linen lying there, as well as the cloth that had been wrapped around Jesus' head. The cloth was still lying in its place, separate from the linen. Finally, the other disciple, who had reached the tomb first, also went inside. He saw and he believed. They still did not understand from Scripture that Jesus had to rise from the dead. Then the disciples went back to where they were staying. Now Mary stood outside the tomb crying. As she wept, she bent over to look into the tomb and saw two angels in white seated where Jesus' body had been, one at the head, the other at the foot. They asked her, "Woman, why are you crying?" "They have taken my Lord away," she said, "and I don't know where they have put him." At this, she turned around and saw Jesus standing there, but she did not realize that it was Jesus. He asked her, "Woman, why are you crying? Who is it you are looking for?" Thinking he was the gardener, she said, "Sir, if you have carried him away, tell me where you have put him, and I will get him." Jesus said to her, "Mary." She turned toward him and cried out in Aramaic, "Rabboni," which means teacher. Jesus said, "Do not hold on to me, for I have not yet ascended to the Father. Go instead to my brothers and tell them, I am ascending to my Father and your Father, to my God and your God." Mary Magdalene went to the disciples with the news, "I have seen the Lord," and she told them that he had said these things to her. All right, a lot packed into that passage. So let's start talking about what it says, what we think it might mean. Just a little bit of background, I think it's important to refresh our minds about what happened before this passage picked up. We had the account of the burial, and I think the key point that we want to remember is that Mary Magdalene was a witness both to the death, both to the crucifixion and death, and to the burial of the body. So she was there throughout. So one thing that really struck me when I read this, to stop thinking about it for this talk today, was this particular account emphasizes that when she starts out, it was still dark. Other gospel accounts talk about it being early in the morning, it being the break of dawn. This one very explicitly says it was dark. To me, that kind of jumped out. And I think it speaks to the darkness that must have been part of Mary's world at this time. Can you imagine the grief that she must have felt? And among all of the people who followed Jesus and cared for Jesus, she probably had a personal relationship with him that was very unique. When Jesus had cast out a number of demons from her, so she was obviously a person who'd been a troubled soul. Jesus had been able to do something for her, to give her a new lease on life. Jesus was willing to tend to her and care for her when nobody else was. So Jesus valued her, validated her as a human being when nobody else would. And now this person that she was so close to and who had done so much for her was gone. He had been executed as a criminal, and now worse than that, she believes the body has been stolen. So she comes, really in this passage it appears she's coming just to visit the tomb to mourn. We don't have any indication that she's bringing any additional spices or coming to do anything else to anoint the body. She was just coming to grieve. So surely what's on her mind would be, what was her life going to be like without Jesus now that he was gone? So we can imagine the depths of her sorrow. And then she gets within sight of the tomb and sees that the stone has been rolled away. So right away, she jumps to the conclusion that somebody's taken the body. They roll back the stone, somebody's taken the body. I find it interesting that she doesn't pursue any further fact-finding. I mean, she just takes it at what for her, I guess, is face value. The stone is rolled back. Somebody must have rolled it back in order to steal the body away. So we see here what we see, I think, again and again and again in all the Gospels on the part of those who are following Jesus. And certainly I think it applies to all of us in our own lives. There's just time after time of this misapprehension, misunderstanding, confusion, missing the point, getting it wrong, jumping to the wrong conclusion. So let's take that as a point to sort of have some dialogue around. And just want to open it up and see if anyone has any thoughts they'd like to share on that notion of sort of not getting it and making mistakes, and also that notion of the darkness that she must have been experiencing.
What I find most interesting about the story is the fact that she didn't recognize Jesus. And, you know, to me, it says that, that what we're talking about here is a resurrection experience. And what's interesting to me is the reaction of the people that had that. And it's not and it's this idea of not, you know, it's not a physical thing. That you don't physically say, oh, there you are, much to our surprise. It has to do with an experience of being once again in relationship with this person that you thought that you had lost.
This is very well put, yeah, I think that. That certainly is picked up on I think it's in 2 Corinthians, the passage about the type of body that will be given to the resurrected. So there is a tradition there. And it is clear that people are not, the resurrected Jesus isn't immediately, it's not obvious that he's the resurrected Jesus. We see that time and again. Other thoughts? Yes.
I think it's interesting that even though the disciples had been around and seen Jesus perform all these miracles, and the raising of Lazarus and so forth, they still didn't believe, it says here, didn't understand when he kept telling them, I'm going to come back.
Mm-hmm. It is. It's fascinating the depth and the prevalence of the misunderstanding, the missing the point, the not getting it. It just, you know, you read this and you wonder, you're trying to be empathetic on one hand, but on the other hand, how much would it take for you to believe? But if you try to transport yourself back in time and be there, I'm sure I would have reacted the very same way that they did. This was so far outside the realm of anything they had experienced. I'm sure when Jesus spoke of these things, they were very confused by what he was saying, and they must have been assuming that he was talking about things that would happen in the distant future, when God, when the end of the world would come.
Well, I think your point about the darkness Mary must have been experiencing, it goes to all of the disciples. And so when you're in that dark spot, and, you know, if you compare it to today, I mean, if you've lost a loved one or, you know, someone that's that close, then here, I mean, it's their Lord. I mean, they believe he is, you know, the Son of God. Mm-hmm. And but they can't get past what they just witnessed or knew about with his torture, you know, on the cross and his suffering and his death. So they're focused on the death and not, so Mary's focused on the death, not the possibility of resurrection when she sees the stone move and assumes it's, you know, somebody's movement.
That's a great point. She's so preoccupied with looking for the body. She's so preoccupied with looking for the corpse that the possibility of resurrection is nowhere in her mind. There's just no room for that for her until she's actually confronted and he actually calls her by name. So that's a moment of tremendous grace and revelation.
As you're speaking, one of the things that struck me was the nature of timelessness or eternity, and what goes on in our mind as to, are we looking or seeking a spiritual body or a earthly body? And Jesus said elsewhere, God is a spirit, and we who worship him, worship him in spirit and in truth. This takes us right into the present day Eucharist, where many of us perhaps are looking at the contrast between what's this bread and wine doing on the altar, this earthly food, and yet at the peak of the Eucharist, the great thanksgiving and the communion, it's the worship of God in spirit and in truth. So it sort of keeps us on our toes looking at it from both directions.
That's a very good point, David, and I think it's sort of thinking about it that way, you can imagine the disciples, they didn't have the benefit of being removed in time from the event, so the event was still very raw for them. Exactly, yeah. Despite the pains to which Jesus went to try to clarify for his followers what he was about and what was going to happen, I think people couldn't help but try to put it into terms that they could get their hands around that was consistent with their understanding of reality. And their understanding of reality did not include people experiencing people in any way after they die. So after she has this brief encounter with Jesus, she, with great urgency, she runs to tell the disciples. And this is I think, a very striking part of the story. She is now the one person on earth who has seen the risen Lord. She is the one who will announce the resurrection to the world. So you can imagine sort of her excitement and her bewilderment and her sense of urgency and just bursting, wanting to share this information with the others. So she goes back and she speaks to Peter and the other disciple, the one whom Jesus loved. That's interesting. That's this person shows up a few times in John. And it seems as though John is seeking to just sort of try to embody in these two disciples the full range of discipleship. So we have Peter, who goes from, you know, batting it out of the park, really doing well, to just abysmal failure. So he went all the way from recognizing that Jesus was the Son of God, and Jesus saying that you are the rock on which I will build my church, and then he does a 180, and he's denying Jesus at the time of the trial.
Well, he might have done a 360, because today's epistle has Peter reading out, hey, this is how it was. Jesus died, was resurrected, etc., etc., and did this and did that and did the other. So,
oh, yeah, no, absolutely. He does eventually come full circle. Absolutely. No, but and at this time, when we pick him up in the story here, he's just come off having denied his relationship.
Yeah.
And so now this other disciple is portrayed as one who embodies love and intimacy with Jesus, is referred to as the one that Jesus loved. So this is a disciple who embodies the goal of discipleship, that is intimate love and relationship, that this is John's vision of discipleship. So he sort of employs this device of choosing these two people, these two characters, to be the part of the story. So again, picking up on the urgency theme, the two of them set off running. I mean, Mary has come back and said to them that that she's had this experience. So the other, presumably younger disciple, reaches the tomb first, but doesn't go in. This is perhaps in deference to Peter. Peter is the more senior. Really don't know why. But because Peter is never short of enthusiasm, he's always jumping into everything, sometimes ahead of himself. But he goes right into the tomb, and he sees the linen cloths. He sees the linen cloths. He sees the cloth that was on the head. And I think these burial cloths, their presence in the tomb, and the condition in which they're found, is a very, very profound image. This is only possible if Jesus has left the tomb and truly left death behind. In leaving the tomb, the burial cloths are removed and they're left there. Contrast with the story of Lazarus, where Jesus raises Lazarus. Lazarus comes out of the tomb wrapped up in his burial cloths. Jesus has to tell him to remove them. Here, we see an empty tomb with the burial cloths left behind. Certainly, it would seem preposterous to conclude that somebody stole the body and went to all the trouble of carefully removing the linens and lying them out like that. So this is perhaps what's going on when it says the other disciple saw and he believed. He believed in the empty tomb. And he believed not merely that the tomb was empty, but that the emptiness bears witness to Jesus conquering death. So he's kind of beginning to get it. He's kind of beginning to get it. Something very miraculous has happened. Jesus has somehow moved beyond earthly death, but he still doesn't get what resurrection means. He still doesn't completely understand the scripture. So at this point, neither of the disciples understand the full meaning and significance of the resurrection. They have yet to meet Jesus and see Jesus and experience the risen Lord and receive their commission and their instructions. And this particular part of the story concludes rather kind of a very kind of way in saying that the disciples return to their homes, for as yet they did not understand the scripture that he must rise from the dead. So again, we see the misunderstanding, the misapprehension, some early sparks, perhaps, on the part of the other disciple, but they're still, they don't leave the tomb energized and proclaiming a message. They leave, go back. Yes?
Well, there still seems to be a few holes in the whole thing that has happened for these people. Where's that body? If they didn't recognize the other fella or the gardener or whatever she thought, it doesn't track yet, because there's still a lot of questions that I'm sure the disciples had. If Jesus has been resurrected, we should recognize him, and he should be walking around and tell us so. You can understand.
Oh, certainly. It's easy to sort of try to put yourself back in their position, and I think absolutely I would have behaved the very same way.
Well, taking back to the actual event itself, if I'm not mistaken, one of the Gospels says that people went to Pilate and said, "Sir, that deceiver said when he was alive that he would rise again. Command, therefore, that you make the tomb very, very secure, setting a guard and with a stone. And so when you see these cloths left in this very precise position, taking that together with the guards falling asleep or what they did, and the stone rolled away, you have to say, hey, if these people were stealing the body of Jesus, they did a pretty good job of it, because mm-hmm. they covered it up pretty well, and it wasn't sort of a rush job where rushed in and did everything and shoved off.
I know, exactly, and it's so interesting. John does not include in his gospel any mention about the guarding of the tomb.
Yeah, I think
or
it's
any of that. But that particular passage, I did read as I was preparing for this, and I was struck by a sort of wry comment that Pilate makes when he's asked to post a guard. He says to them, "Well, go and make the tomb as secure as you can."
Yeah, I think it's interesting to think about the fact that Mary went first to the tomb, then she went and told the disciples, and they came and saw it empty, and they left immediately, and she stayed behind, and then she sees him. Significantly, maybe it's the fact that they not only went home, they went home and locked the door. They were still in fear of their lives.
Mm-hmm.
They ran away in the garden during the prayers before mm-hmm. the crucifixion. And now they still don't understand all this, so they're probably still frightened that somebody's going to come and get them.
Sure. And I think, some of the commentary that I read on this passage as I was getting ready for this made the point that Mary herself was going to visit the tomb at no small risk to her own safety. And she was known to be an affiliate of Jesus, so she was as much in danger of being apprehended as one of his followers, anybody else. So certainly, yeah, that's...
Why didn't Jesus appear to the disciples when they were there? Why did he wait for them to leave and then come to Mary?
Yeah, there's a lot of very interesting questions that this passage raises for us. And that's, so here we are in the story now. Mary is lingering at the tomb. The disciples have come, they've seen the empty tomb, they've gone off. I mean, they're confused, they're frightened, they left. But Mary is just overwhelmed with grief. She can't put one foot in front of the other. She can just stand there at the tomb and weep. So you can just try to empathize with this abysmal grief and despair that she must have been feeling. But she finally brings herself to be able to bend down and take a look into the tomb. When she does that, the story tells us that she sees two angels, one seated where the head would have been, the other seated where the foot would have been. And it's interesting that perhaps because she was so overwhelmed with grief, she doesn't seem too perturbed about this angelic vision that she's having. Now, maybe these angels kind of came in a more low-key sort of way and not with the trumpets blaring, so to speak. But they ask her, why are you weeping? And she tells them, somebody has taken my Lord. They've taken the body, and I don't know where they've taken him. So she's just absolutely grief-stricken and totally focused on wanting to find his body. Where did it go? Who took it? Where is it? So then at this point, she has a sense something causes her to turn around. She's bent down looking into the tomb, sees the angels, has this brief exchange with them, and something causes her to turn around. Perhaps she sensed that someone was there, but she turns around and there's this person there. And it's Jesus, but she doesn't realize that it's She supposes that this person is the gardener. And so Jesus says to her, why are you weeping? Who is it that you're looking for? And she again said, they've taken away my Lord. If you were part of this, if you know who took him, please tell me. I want to go and get him and bring him back. And at that point, Jesus looks her in the eye and calls her by name, Mary. Suddenly, she realizes who Jesus is. This is, I think, getting to your point, that this is where she's now face to face with the resurrected Jesus. So it suggests that the resurrected appearance is not a snapshot of the earthly appearance. But she realizes that it's him. Now you can imagine the flood of emotion that she must have felt at this point. Here she was in this abyss of grief, and now suddenly there he is calling her by name. I'm sure she's wondering, am I imagining this? Is this really happening? And she calls out, she calls teacher, and her immediate instinct is to want to grab a hold of Jesus, is to want to be in physical contact with him. But Jesus says, no, don't hold on to me. I have not yet ascended to the Father. So in John's gospel, the ascension is a bit more of a dynamic and ongoing event than some of the others. But he tells her, you know, rather than holding on to me, I want you to go back to my brothers and tell them that I am ascending to my Father and to your Father, to my God and to your God. This is what he tells Mary to relate back to the disciples. But this is really an important point here where Jesus is indicating that all of his followers now are referred to as family, as brothers. And the word actually doesn't, as according to the commentaries that I've read, I can't vouch I don't speak Greek, but they say that the Greek word does not convey gender, that it means family members. So now this Jesus is ascending, and he is creating this opportunity for all who believe in him, for all of his followers, to have the same intimate relationship with God that he has. And this is really where, if you will, the rubber does meet the road. This is where sort of everything is pulled together. The crucifixion, the cross, brings the incarnation to a close. The incarnate Jesus is dead on the cross. But the story of Jesus, the story of the Word, only finds its conclusion when Jesus returns to God. And that return makes possible new life for the believing community. Jesus' ascent to God is a permanent event. This is sealing it forever. The incarnation was an event in time. It had a beginning, a middle, and an end. The ascension is this permanent sealing of this new relationship. So you have this cross resurrection and ascension that John is very focused on. And that's forever changing the way God is known in the world and makes God's new age a reality. So let's stop there and see. Yeah.
I always had a little, Jesus died on Good Friday, right? So, and then it says on the third day he rose again. Well, 3 days from Friday isn't Sunday. So why do we celebrate the risen thing on Sunday when that's not 3 days from Friday?
It's the oddities of how the Jews counted the days. So Friday would have been day one. He died on the cross Friday afternoon, so that day ended at sunset. So then day number two would have been Saturday, sunrise to sunset. And then Sunday would be the third day, sunrise, Sunday. It's the oddities of how they counted time.
So that would have been sunset, though, on Sunday, right? Rather than our early morning.
Right, yeah, they weren't operating on that. They didn't mark the days in sort of 24-hour cycles that we do. They did it more sort of based on the rising and setting of the sun. And that's my best take on it. I read fair amount about it. Did anybody else have any comments? Anyone's
well,
read about this?
They still celebrate like Passover, and they start at sundown.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Still
do so the end. Yeah. The end of the day. It's a good question. There's lots of details like that that can really get you tripped up when you're reading this
well,
stuff.
What kind of time frame is this happening? How many days after he died is Mary coming?
This is happening on Easter Sunday morning.
Because he claims he is not yet risen. So maybe
he's risen. He's risen. He's saying that he has not yet ascended to the Father.
Oh.
He's distinguishing between this, and this is what John makes a big deal out of, this distinction between the resurrection and the ascension. So the resurrection is the overcoming, is the defeat of death. And then the ascension is the final, if you will, the sealing of the deal for eternity, of
so
this new relationship with God.
How soon does he do that? How soon?
It varies. It's different Gospels. Now in John, we still got another appearance coming up next week, the Doubting Thomas. And I think the ascension happens pretty quickly after that in John. Some of the others, it's 40 days. One of the other Gospels, it's 40 days. And in at least one of them, it's the same day. There's an appearance and then it goes up. Anybody got any expertise on that issue?
By the fact that Jesus appeared first to a woman, and in ancient culture they were completely inconsequential.
Mm-hmm.
That's why she could come and go from the garden and the tomb, whereas the other disciples were afraid because she was much less likely, because nobody cared what women did, particularly poor women. So he appeared to her before anyone else. You know, sometimes you think to yourself, well, what if he'd appeared to Pilate? To the Pharisees or to the whole group of disciples, but he did not. He appeared to her first, because this was such a from the very bottom down revolution, not a top down revolution, bottom up, from the start of Christianity with Jesus' birth, from the bottom up.
That's such a good point, and it's so very well said that it would have been completely outside the meaning and message of what he was about for him to have appeared to anybody in the power structure. That they were not the people that he was worried about. They were not the people he was trying to win over. He was trying to speak to the average person, in particular to the people at the bottom, the people who were being trampled upon.
Mary not only being a woman, but an entirely flawed individual from some of the dispute over whether she was or was not.
Yeah, I think she's been given
somebody who required the healing of Jesus.
She did. She was certainly she had these issues about she had experiences of being possessed, whatever that might be. I would assume she probably had today's world we might think of as some perhaps depression. But whatever it was, Jesus in his presence in her life helped her through that. She gained a new lease on life by becoming a follower of Jesus. And her steadfastness and the steadfastness of the other women in their faith is such a compelling part of the Easter narrative. And they're the ones who they stay there at the cross. For the very end, they go see that the body is properly buried. They come on the third day. They're the ones who are there, being much more faithful than the guys would be. Any other thoughts on that?
I'll just give the men some credit. I think it's interesting that when she went back, they didn't just say, she's just saying something, but they actually went. I mean, they went for themselves to see.
Right.
You know,
yeah.
They didn't respond.
They did. No, they did respond, and I think it speaks to that sort of human curiosity. You know, come back, and, the stone is rolled back. He's gone.
Yeah. They were barely going to just take the word for it.
Right.
Yeah. Certainly, regardless of whatever happened, if in fact the tomb had been tampered with, that it would mean something to them, and they'd want to know firsthand what had happened. So Mary does end up being the first person to proclaim the risen Jesus, This story ends with this So a very upbeat note that we are now going to be able to have this relationship through Jesus, this relationship with God in a new and different way going forward. So it's marking a dramatic point in human history. Any other thoughts on this? This is a very rich passage. So next week we'll talk about Doubting Thomas, and then the last week the Word from May. So thank you for your attention. Thanks for coming.